Imagine earning continuing education credits while doing exactly what you're doing right now. Well, you can. Gable Media has revolutionized the way you earn your continuing education credits with a groundbreaking approach. Forget running around town and scouring the internet for credit-worthy courses. Fulfill your CE requirements effortlessly by listening to engaging podcasts just like the one you're listening to now. Our podcasts are designed to educate, entertain, and inspire, all in a user-friendly environment. But wait, there's more. Architects, Gable Media is also approved as an AIA Continuing Education Services provider. Upon completion, we handle everything, from reporting your hours directly to the AIA to storing your certificates in your personal Gable Media profile for your self-reporting needs. So follow the link in the show notes and start earning your credits in the most innovative and entertaining way possible with Gable Media.
My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Today, I'm sharing something a little different here on the Entree Architect Podcast. A few weeks ago, I joined the hosts of Home, The Second Story, to talk about a project that's deeply personal to me, the renovation of our 1934 cottage in Chappaqua, New York, and the lessons Anne Marie and I learned as both architects and homeowners. It was a rare chance to step out of the host's chair and reflect on the home that shaped our lives, our practice, and ultimately the beginnings of Entree Architect. I'm very grateful to Sherry, Taylor, and Marilyn for creating such a thoughtful space for that conversation to happen. But before we jump into today's episode, it's supported by RCAT. If you want to work smarter on your projects, start your product research at RCAT.com. From BIM and CAD details to up-to-date specifications and product data, RCAT gives you everything in one place. And it's all free. So make RCAT.com part of your workflow. That's RCAT.com, ARCAT.com, RCAT.com. Now, let's listen in to our conversation at Home, The Second Story.
Hi, and welcome to Home, The Second Story. We are three residential architects sharing real conversations with homeowners who've taken on custom home or renovation projects. If you haven't already, check out our first episode to hear more about us and why we're doing this. I'm Sherry Scott from Springhouse Architects in Cincinnati, joined by my co-hosts.
I'm Taylor Davis of TPD Architect in Birmingham, Alabama.
And I'm Marilyn Modinger of Runcible Studios, based in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and Boston, Massachusetts. Today, we are honored and delighted to have Mark LePage with us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome, Mark.
Hi. Good to have you. Good to be here. I'm so used to saying good to have you.
Turn of event,
right? Yes, hi. This is a rare opportunity.
That's a spoiler for our upcoming conversation about why we all just laughed about that. So, but first, we're going to do our lightning round of our quick five questions about your project. So, first of all, where was the project located?
The project was located in Chappaqua, New York, in Westchester County, just above New York City in New York.
Was it a new build, addition, renovation, some combination?
It was an addition and renovation.
When did you start the project and when did you move in?
We purchased the house in 1997, did a quick renovation, and then did some bunch of other things, but we moved in right after we purchased it. But
nice.
It's a part of the story.
Okay. Yeah, we'll get to all that. What size house is it?
When we purchased it, it was 900 square feet. It was 30 by 30.
Yep. Nice. And it didn't end at 900.
We added a little bit. Not a lot, but we did add to it. We made it livable.
And our last question here in this lightning round, there are a lot of ways to work with an architect, and our guests usually, are not architects themselves. So curious to hear how you worked with an architect on this project specifically. Yeah.
That's an interesting question because I did work with an architect. I am an architect and my wife is an architect. And so I am married to an architect. She did most of the design and led most of the architectural process. So I could share more of that. But
yeah. Well, we definitely want to hear more of that. And I feel like I'm going to add question six here, which is, I feel like we should talk about how we all know each other. Before we get, you know, rolling on the whole story here, we're baby podcasters. Mark's the real deal. So Mark, you were saying before we started, you've been podcasting since when?
2012.
And we've all been guests, by the way. So everyone should go listen to Entree Architect Podcast, right?
Yes. Entree Architect Podcast. It launched on December 12th, 2012. And I just recently, yesterday, recorded my 634th episode.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Congratulations.
Yep. Yes.
And thanks to you. You were all part of that 634.
Mark is the reason why we all know each other in the first place. So, Mark, do you want to say just a little bit quick about Entree Architect and kind of how the genesis of it and how maybe we three cool people fit into that story?
Yeah, for sure. I'm an architect, like I mentioned, and in the late 2000s, I started writing a blog called Entrepreneur Architect. I was the business side of my firm and my wife was the design side of the firm. And so I loved business. And so I started a blog called Entrepreneur Architect to just find information on the web and put it into this blog for myself so I can go back and reference it. And because it was so early, there was very few blogs, if any, that were being written by architects about business specifically. It found an audience of other architects, and a community of people started to form in the comments. It was way before social media, 2007, 2008, somewhere around there was when that blog started. And a community of architects formed in the comments. Every time I posted, a bunch of architects would show up and make their points made in the comments, and they would start talking back and forth, and a community, a real true community, was born. And that community over the years kept encouraging me to turn it into something bigger. Specifically, you three were a big part of that and kept saying, you know, this should be more than just a blog. And so after many, many years of procrastinating and saying, I'm going to do this. In late 2012, I realized that the date 12/12/12 was coming up, December 12th, 2012. And so I said, okay, if I'm going to do this, I have to put it out there that I'm going to, you know, commit to launching this. But I didn't tell anybody what I was going to do. So I wrote a blog post called My 12/12/12 Project. All it said was, I am going to do something significant on December 12th, 2012. Calling it my 12/12/12 project. And it is something that will change my life, going to change the lives of others, and to hopefully impact the world.
I remember that. I remember that specific blog. And I was thinking, what is he going
to
do?
Yeah. And so that was my way to finally do it, right? It took me about 4 years to finally commit to doing it because I was afraid. It was just pure fear. Why me? What could it become? What if it does become successful? How does it change my life as an architect? Yeah. And so December 12, 2012, I committed to doing it and I launched at 12:12 p.m. So got to go for the whole
amazing
thing. I launched entrearchitect.com specifically as a platform to help small firm architects build better businesses, and launched the Entree Architect podcast the same day. Soon after that, with the intent of turning this into a business and a platform that would grow beyond me, I launched membership. And the membership was the Academy. And the Academy was a mastermind group. And the three of you and a bunch of other people came together and became the first cohort of the Entree Architect Academy mastermind groups. And the rest is history. We're still doing mastermind groups. We have over 30 mastermind groups today at Entree Architect.
Amazing.
And we have business resources and the episodes of, you know, podcasts and all kinds of things.
It's amazing. And just hearing you say that you started that blog in 2007, 2008, that's when I started my business. It's like it was, It was instrumental in me building my business. Not only you, Mark, but the people that you brought together that, you know, ended up being friends and colleagues and meeting at conferences. And it just, it made such a difference in my business, which then of course extends to my life. And I want to thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I appreciate all of it.
Well, and you said that your goal was to do something that would change the world and change people's lives. And here we are.
I mean, I remember sitting reading the blog posts at my breakfast room table, and my husband came in at 11. I think I've told you, Mark, this story before he was going to bed, and he was like, "What are you doing?" I was like, "I'm reading this guy, and he like knows everything, and like I need to absorb more because he's answering all the questions that nobody else can answer." And at that point in my household, you earned the nickname the Swami, and ever since then, my husband has called you the Swami.
The Swami. That's funny.
Well, I think it's just a testament too to the power of sharing knowledge and bringing everybody together around these sorts of topics and providing not just the knowledge sharing, but also the support. And I know it was a big impetus to the three of us starting this podcast as well, is to say, what would be helpful given the knowledge that we have and the experience that we have? What would be helpful to a larger platform, to people? How can we take this and take it beyond the conversations that we have together internally and help people with their projects? So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. You're very welcome. You were a significant instrumental part of the launch of it. And so it is reciprocal that I appreciate you as much as you appreciate what I've built. And so it would not exist unless people like you became part of it and shared your knowledge. One of the mantra that I have that I share at the end of my podcast is love, learn, share. And that's my message to the world, is if we can just love more and care about one another and learn as much as we can and then share as much as we can, you know, the world can become a better place. And if I could do that in a small microcosm of architects who are trying to help one another in a profession that for generations hid their information and would not share and were very competitive. Yes. And, you know, I wanted to change that. And over the time, the architects came together and formed a community. And I just put it out there. I just built the framework, and the people who came together are the ones who turned it into what it is today.
Well, in the end, all of that helps homeowners, which is all ultimately what we're also interested in doing.
Exactly.
Is helping the profession be better at being architects and running sound businesses and having good practices means that we're able to serve homeowners better. And that's our passion too, as practicing residential architects, right? Is to figure out how to serve. So in the spirit of sharing,
yes,
we're going to put you back on the hot seat.
That's right.
All right. Sounds good.
Enough of this love fest.
Yeah, exactly.
Go sharing.
Okay, so Mark, relative to your project in New York, we want to hear all about that process and how it went and what you learned. And so what did life look like before you started this project? What was the catalyst that made you say, okay, now is the time to really do this?
Anne-Marie is my wife. Anne-Marie and I were married in 1996. And we lived in a town called Pleasantville in New York, just above New York City. And we lived in a little teeny tiny apartment, and we wanted to buy a house. And two architects trying to find the perfect house is complicated. And so for almost a year and a half, about a year, we had a realtor who we were driving crazy, trying to find the right house. And, you know, they kept bringing us to houses that, you know, just weren't what we were looking for. Mm-hmm. And one day in the summer, she took us to this house. She said, "This house is going on the market tomorrow. And they're going to let us see it first before the open house." And so we got in the realtor's car. She took us to the house. We turned into this private driveway and drove up this hill in a town called Chappaqua that we were not even looking in because it was way out of our budget. It was one of those towns in Westchester County, New York, where all the bankers and all the traders, all the people who make all the money in New York City live, right? They live in Westchester County in Greenwich, Connecticut. And so we weren't even looking in Chappaqua. And so we're like, this isn't going to happen. This is not going to be a house we can even afford, never mind the house that we're looking for after a year of being disappointed. So we drive up this private driveway. That was the first hint. We're like, private driveway? There's no way we're going to be able to afford this house, private driveway. And so we drive up this driveway and past two other houses on the driveway. So it's a shared driveway, and go up a hill and into the woods. We're going into the woods. It's like, oh my goodness, this is awesome, right? This is one of the things we want. And so we drive up, and up on the hill, as we're coming up the hill, up above us is this little tiny stucco cottage with this little wooden door, this round top door with this perfect little gable. It was just this square, 30 by 30 with this little square roof, or a little gable roof. And it was perfect. So we looked at it, and we both looked at each other immediately and thought, oh, this is going to be good. Mm-hmm. And it was very overgrown. The trees have all overgrown, and the plantings look like they're probably 50 years old. And the driveway, I had two stone piers at the driveway. So you come up this shared driveway, and then you would have to go into our private driveway. You sort of turn off the shared road and into our driveway, and this little short gravel, at the time it was dirt. It wasn't even gravel. It was just dirt. And you go past these two piers that were like 80 years old, and look up at the house, and it's like this perfect house, this big stone retaining wall, all like 80 year old stone, field stone wall. And it was like a tan stucco with dark red trim, and it had like pasted on wood to make it look like a Tudor. It wasn't a Tudor, but they sort of pretended it was a Tudor. Somewhere along the line, they did that. And we were like so excited about this. And it was priced at a price that was above our budget, but it wasn't unmanageable. So we're like, maybe this could work. And so we walk up the stairs and we walk in the front door, and it was a disaster. It was a disaster. They were still living in it because the open house was the next day, and they hadn't yet cleaned it up. I don't know how they cleaned it up for the open house. They probably didn't, but it was a hoarder. It was 3 feet of stuff and probably 50, 60 years of life in this house that had not been painted in generations. And the walls were all dirty and sticky and moldy. Anybody else who would have walked into that door would have been disgusted, and they would have turned around and left. But Anne-Marie and I walked in and said, "Hey, oh my goodness, this is going to be great. This is perfect." Because beyond all of that, exactly, beyond all of the mess and the dirt and the mold, we saw the original crown moldings. And we saw the original fireplace and the original mantle and the original hardware and the original light fixtures and the original textured plaster on the walls. We looked right past the mess and fell in love with this little tiny house that had been neglected for 50 years that nobody else would have. Anybody who would have walked into it would have said, this is a teardown. We're not even messing with this, because it literally had not been updated ever. It had from 1934, it was built, and it had never been updated. It had the original fuse box with two fuses. It had the original kitchen. The kitchen was about 8 by 10, and it had the original porcelain sink and this built-in cupboard. And the refrigerator was blocking the door to the back deck because they didn't have refrigerators that size or at all. 1934, and the stove was this original 1940 stove, the little white stove, and everything was
like a time capsule.
A time capsule, and we just totally fell in love with it. Obviously, it was going to be a lot of work, but it also allowed us to afford this house, right? And it was all there because it was so neglected it had never been updated. All the original stuff was still there. The original light fixtures and the original plaster and all of that stuff that most houses built in the 30s, it's all been gutted somewhere along the line. And so a house that's built in 1934 that still has all of the 1934 life and design and details is unheard of.
And a hidden treasure.
Exactly. And so we immediately put an offer on it. And they were not supposed to be in the house, but they were. And they met us.
That's a no-no, right?
Yes. But because they met us, we told them that we were architects and that we loved the house.
And that you loved it.
And this was a house that they had lived in for 50 years. This was the second generation who owned it. Mm-hmm. And the person who it was actually the man and the woman who bought it, the man had died probably in the 70s. And that we've heard afterwards through becoming friends with the owners, that when the husband died, the wife didn't want to change anything. Mm. She wanted to preserve the house that was his house. And over the years, it just neglected. She didn't even want anybody to repair it. And so it just continued the way it was from the day he died. And so as a time capsule, like you said, it was a time capsule of the day he died. It never changed. But because they met us and they knew that we wanted to preserve it and they loved it and they didn't want it to die or be torn down because they knew that was what was going to happen. They accepted our offer. It was a cash offer lower than they were asking. And it worked for us and it worked for them and they accepted it. And the realtor convinced them to go ahead with the open house the next day.
Of course.
And so they had the open house and we're sitting, in our apartment waiting for the news because they hadn't officially accepted. They basically verbally accepted it.
Right.
And so we had a deal with the owner, but there was nothing signed. We had no contract. And the next day they had a full open house and they had three offers cash for more from developers who were going to tear it down to build a big house. And they were going to make lots of money. And they held to their agreement with us. And they sold it to us.
Amazing.
What a great story.
Yeah.
Aww. So did you live in it as is?
We could not live in it the way it was. We took about 2 weeks to clean it up and make it livable. It was just Anne-Marie and me and some friends. And our parents came and helped because we were living at Anne-Marie's friend's house because we had moved from, we did not renew the apartment and we bought this house and we expected to move in. And so we were temporarily living at Anne-Marie's friend's house. So we started doing this cleanup renovation. So basically clean it, right? Get everything. It had been emptied, right? So it was just an empty box. But the mold was still there and the dirt was still there. And so we spent days and days scrubbing it down and cleaning it and making it beautiful again and repainting everything. And then had the floors refinished. The original fur floors were there under all gorgeous. That stuff. So the floors were actually in really good condition because they were protected by all the stuff. So we had floors refinished. We had the old, there was vinyl on top of linoleum. We had that. Mm. We actually did all the work ourselves except for the floor finishing. We removed all the linoleum, scraped it. It was horrible.
It's horrible. That is horrible.
And and had the floors refinished all the way into the kitchen. And then about 2 days into moving back in, I was moving the big heavy radiators around. And the next day we were at the storage unit and I dropped a towel and I went down to pick up the towel and my back popped.
No.
And I could not get back up and I had excruciating pain and was completely disabled before we moved in.
Oh my God.
And so they got me into the car and they drove me back to Anne-Marie's friend's house and put me on the couch. And I spent another week laying on her couch immobilized. Because if I moved, I couldn't breathe.
While Anne-Marie moved all those boxes.
And Anne-Marie and her parents and help of friends
moved
everything back into the house. And then eventually I got back into the house and So that was the first piece of it, was getting it available to live in, to make it healthy, mm-hmm. right? To make it livable. And so that was the first phase. So we had three phases on that house.
What was the start of the second phase?
The second phase was an addition.
How long after you moved in?
It was quite a bit. We lived in, and that's a whole other, all these memories are coming back.
Yeah, I bet.
We lived in it for several years, had kids. And so we had our first James, and then we had Henry, and Henry was about a year and a half old when we did that. And he was born in 2004. And so 2005, I guess we did the addition, and we did the addition, not because we had the money, but because Anne-Marie's father one day came by and saw that we were giving his grandson a bath in the bathtub, and there was not enough hot water. And so every day we would take boiling water from the kitchen that we would boil on the stove, and we would bring it through the house to the one bathroom that we had, because we only had one bathroom, and fill up the little kiddie bathtub with hot water. And so he could have a bath. And we were just living that way. It was just, that's the necessity of living in a house like that. And the house had no insulation. And so in the winters, it was cold. So our James would sleep in a snowsuit. It was too cold. And again, we were two 20-year-olds.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. That's just how we lived. And we didn't have the money to fix it. And we were saving. And eventually we would fix it. And my father-in-law, who is an amazing man, who I love tremendously, both my in-laws are amazing people, said, we're going to do this addition. And he lent us the money to do the addition, and we fixed it. So what we did is we replaced all of the windows, put all new, brand new windows in, made them look like the old original windows. So all, had the same patterns, and basically we restored it to look the original house. We put a second floor on it, and which was just big enough to have a master bedroom. So we sort of tucked it in under the roof. So we added a second floor, but had a really low roof. So it still kept the scale down. And we added an addition on the back. So we enlarged the kitchen and the dining room. The dining room. That's funny. I call it a dining room. It literally was the hallway from the living room into the kitchen, because it was 30 by 30 was the original house. Right. And so that original house had two bedrooms, a living room, a little alcove they called the dining room, and this little kitchen that I described earlier in the back corner, and then a stair that went down to the basement, had a full basement. And under the bedroom was a one-car garage that could fit a 1934 vehicle with this big carriage door, swinging carriage doors on it. That was what we bought. And so we added the space above it, put in an addition off the back. So basically put a square off the back square. So sort of a square on the back corner where the kitchen was. So we made a larger kitchen, a larger dining room, and added a stair up to the second floor, which was basically right on top of the old stair that went down to the basement. And that gave us a master bedroom suite upstairs. We put another bathroom upstairs. The whole entire space was just big open room, with the idea that in the future you could block it off and make it additional rooms. We didn't have the septic to have four bedrooms, so we had three bedrooms. So bedroom upstairs, bathroom upstairs, larger kitchen, larger dining room. And finished the basement. That was what we did on the first project, and started our architecture firm in the basement. Actually started the architecture firm in the basement before we did any of that. And so that was phase two.
So how did that process look? Like, what, I know you guys are both architects. Yeah. So did you spend years planning, or, take us through that process a little bit?
We had a much more difficult time finding the house than designing and building it, because that was our expertise. And I learned a long time ago, way before I married my wife, that she is an exceptional designer. and that when we try to design together, it doesn't work.
Yeah. That's very good to know.
Which is yes. why I took the business side and she took the design side of the firm. But we did the same. I do the same. I've always done it since I learned that, because we tried to design once together and it did not work
once.
In any way. Exactly. And so we never wanted to experience that relationship again. And so we never did that again. And so I defer all design to Amory. She's an exceptional designer. She does great work, interiors and architecture. And so it was very easy. She designed what she wanted. And I said, that looks great. Let's do it.
Nice.
And then we went through the process with the town and got the permits, and none of it was really difficult because that was our, you know, that was our job. And that project was our project, our firm. We served people just like us. Our whole firm was built and branded around serving families who are moving from New York City out into the country, which isn't really the country, but they called it the country. And there's no place to build new houses in Westchester County because it's old. And so everything is in renovation. So our whole firm's mission was to help these families modernize and update these old houses. And so it was easy to do our own project in terms of the process. The thing that we didn't expect, and we were sort of a little bit naive, we were 27 years old. When we did the addition, we were in our early 30s, but you know, young architects, we thought we were going to live through it. My in-laws lived about a half hour away over the Hudson River in Nyack in Rockland County, for anybody who knows that area. So about 30 minutes away. So our kids were there. We moved our kids off to grandma's house and who were integrated into our lives. It's a whole nother story. That's how Anne-Marie and I actually ran our firm and allowed Anne-Marie to practice, was that my in-laws were a huge part of the support system to allow us to do that. And so the kids were not there, but we decided we were going to live, you know, through the renovation. We were going to stay there.
Did you hire someone this time?
Hire someone for what?
To do the work.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. We were not doing the work.
So we hired a contractor. We weren't going to do anything that big. So we hired a contractor. We did construction management. So we hired multiple contractors. We hired the builder, we hired the plumber, so we managed the construction, but we didn't do the work. But what happened is that the first day they tore off the roof because they had put a second floor on, and they put a tarp over the roof, and they tore off the back of the house because we wanted to put on this new addition off the back of it. And we're living in the bedroom, you know, right back to the old days where we're carrying boiling
camping
water.
Out in your house.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We're camping out in the house, and it started to rain.
Oh my gosh, of course it did.
And the water started pouring through the middle of the house. Like right down through the middle of the house into the basement. And we're like, all right, we're going to grandma's. We're done with this. You know, because that's not uncommon for water to get into a renovation. You know, you clean it up and you fix it and you do what you need to do. But to live in it, to like trying to be sleeping and the water coming down through your house, and it was not a good idea.
And I'm glad you're saying this because it's one of the conversations that comes up with homeowners all the time. Yes. Everyone wants to live in the house during the renovation. Everybody. Even if we're gutting it, they're like, well, just build us a little kitchen in the basement with a microwave and a mini fridge and we'll be fine. And I'm like, you won't be. So that's interesting to, I mean, I grew up in a house where we did a renovation while we lived in it. And partially that trauma is, you know, why I say that.
I am in my fifth month of living in my basement during a bathroom renovation.
Yeah.
Currently.
I do not take my own advice at all.
I never tell people to live there. And yet there I am. No winter clothes, no nothing. Month five.
I think that's valuable experience as well. Like, you know, to be able to tell that to homeowners and say, do you really want to be waking up in the middle of the night and the water's coming through the middle of your house?
And that's the story I would tell when my clients would come to me and say, can we live through it? No, you can't live through it. You have to move.
Not if the roof's off.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes you can, but if it's a major renovation where, you know, the exterior weather is going to be inside your house, you can't live through it. You have to find a place to live.
And the other part is, and I'm sure you face this as well, the subcontractors and everybody need to work. And if they're working around you and they have to hook up the electrical every night, make sure right. the water's on every night, and they can't come at 6 a.m. because you're getting ready for work or whatever, like they'll go slower.
So. Exactly. And they'll charge you more. If a contractor knows that you're going to be living in the house, they won't tell you, but the price will be more than if you just give them free rein to do their job and to do what they do, the price will be lower. And if they have to work around you, the price is going to be higher.
They're
going to
charge you. Yep. We should put that in flashing lights. Warning. Yes. Yes. Warning.
Yes. Giant yellow flag.
So that was phase two.
Yes, that was phase two. So at the end of phase two, we had the second floor finished. We had the addition built, but the addition wasn't finished. So the dining room was drywalled and painted, but you know, there was no trim. And the kitchen again was painted, and had a little bit of trim, but it was just to make it. You know, actually the windows did have trim in the dining room. The kitchen also had trim on the windows, but it was really just to make it look finished. So it was painted and trimmed, but it wasn't finished. And the kitchen, we'd put in a temporary IKEA kitchen because we couldn't afford the kitchen. We could just afford the addition and to get it up and running and to make it livable for our children without having to carry boiling water across the house. So with that renovation, we also did a full new HVAC system and full all new plumbing and new electric, put in an all new 200 amp electrical panel. So fully modernized the house.
That's another tip to homeowners too. Like when you're doing a renovation, that's the time to do all of that stuff.
Yes.
If you've got stuff open and available, I want everybody to listen to that, because if you've got anything that is bugging you about your HVAC or electrical, if you're doing an addition, even if it's just partial addition, that's the time to handle all of that stuff.
The other thing about that is if you don't do it then, you're going to have to do it later when you do other things. It's going to be a huge mess. And also, these are the things that homeowners don't count when they're adding up their potential budget. They're like, oh, a kitchen is going to cost this, the additional cost this. And my first question when we start talking about scope is, how old is your HVAC system? Mm-hmm. Because you're going to have to, oh, well, you know, the unit's about 15 years old. Like, we're replacing that sucker. We are not going through all this and adding all this stuff and adding all this ductwork and doing all this stuff. And then you're going to replace the whole system in 2 years after you finish the renovation. So
yeah, it'll be a lot more expensive too.
Again, way more expensive
to do it later. That's why we didn't have the kitchen finished. And that's why the dining room wasn't finished, because we decided to do the other pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're doing all the stuff that's in the walls that's hard to do later.
But no fun.
No
it's
fun.
No fun to pay for not those things.
Exactly. And not nobody it. Talks about it at a party.
You can't show like your guests
how comfortable you are.
Like, guys, I just rewired my whole building. I just separated my utilities.
You want to see this pictures of the wires?
Yeah, check it out.
Knob and look tube. Turn modern.
Yeah.
I know. This is why I don't get invited to parties.
That's why homeowners would much rather see the, you know, have a kitchen than to, you know, upgrade their HVAC, because you can't see any of that stuff.
You can't see it. But the way you did it was set it up so that then
exactly.
I'm hoping that phase three is like the fun stuff.
That is phase three. Phase three is a little bit of do it yourself. So I finished out the dining room. I did all new wood paneling. So I put in all new wood paneling in the dining room and crown molding. And so finished the dining room, then repainted it the colors we really wanted it to be. And then the kitchen, we put in a brand new, beautiful kitchen that, you know, met the level of the standard of the neighborhood. And that was important too, right? That yep. we're going to put all this effort into saving this house. We wanted to make sure that when we were ready to leave, that because we looked at owning that house as being stewards of that house.
Yeah.
That for one, we rescued it, right? It was going to be torn down. And so part of our feeling was that we are rescuing this house, and we have to make sure that we are setting it up to survive beyond us, because the next builder is right behind us, ready to tear it down when we sell it. We don't want to sell it to a builder either that's going to tear it down. Mm-hmm. So we made sure that whatever we did to it, we built it to the level that made it much more difficult to tear it down. So the kitchen, we put in a beautiful crown point kitchen, and put in beautiful appliances and stretched to do all that. But that's why it was phase three.
Yeah.
You know, we saved our money to build what we wanted and then designed and built, you know, phase three was to finish the kitchen and the dining room.
How long was it between the second phase and the third phase? Did you live there for a while?
Yeah, a couple of years. I don't remember exactly, but it was several years, maybe. I don't know. But yeah, it wasn't right away because we were saving our money to make sure that we can do that. Yeah.
The big kitchen.
My father-in-law wasn't going to help me with the second one, although he did end up.
No, you just got hot water. Yeah.
Another thing that homeowners are often asking us in renovations is, can I phase the project? So they want to do it as you're describing. So phase one, phase two, phase three.
Yeah.
What you're describing is basically for several years, maybe the better part of a decade, you are doing a variety of projects or saving for projects or being under construction. So given what you experienced, what would you advise homeowners if you showed up, if a homeowner called you and said, I just bought this house?
Yeah.
What's the game plan?
The projects that we would have as architects.
Yeah.
And so the first thing we would do is master plan. If somebody had a big project and they could not afford the whole project, do a master plan. So design it all out, get it all on paper, just like you want. But the architect knows that it's going to be multi-phased. And so they'll design it differently than if they were going to build it potentially differently than if they were all going to build it at one time. Right? They're two different projects. If you said, I have $1 million to do exactly what I want, or I have $500,000 to do part of what I want, that project will be designed in different ways.
Yeah.
So design out the whole project. Plan it out. What's going to be phase one? What's going to be phase two? What's going to be phase three? Put some preliminary numbers on what those things will be. And then go through your phases. Build phase one. But when you build phase one, preparing for phase two, like us, if you do build something that isn't going to be completely finished, finish it enough in a different way. You know, save your money. Do it inexpensively. But finish it so you can live in it, right? Because life goes really fast.
Yeah.
Right. And so if you just have an empty room that someday is going to be the kitchen, right? But you don't really have a kitchen. That's not a good example. But if you're like maybe the dining room, like the dining room, eventually we wanted this paneled dining room, but you know, it's not going to happen right away. So we finished the dining room, painted it, trimmed it out. Anybody who walked into it would think, oh, it's a nice dining room, but it wasn't what we imagined. But it would, you know, it was finished enough to live in it. So you don't want to live in construction your whole life.
No.
I lived in a house like that. You know, my father did all the work on the house that we grew up in, and it was constantly under construction.
Yeah.
We lived in a constant renovation, which is, you know, lead me to architecture and construction and taught me a lot. And so there's a good side to that as well. But it also, you know, you raise your family in construction on plywood floors and unfinished walls and, you know, cold breezes. And I would recommend that you finish it enough that you live in it and you can enjoy it. And then when you're ready for phase two, you know, take out the stuff that was inexpensive to put in that you enjoyed for a couple of years and then build phase two and then phase three.
Yeah, that makes sense. And especially these days, you know, right now, with construction prices being what they are, it's difficult to come up with a giant chunk of money to do the whole project potentially. So, smart phasing has got to be it. You know, you got to think about that.
What I like about the way you talk about phasing is a little bit different because a lot of times what we see, and we've talked about this before, is that people kind of want to draw a red line around a part of their plan and call that phase one and then draw another red line around it and call it phase two and act as if I talk about it. I was like, this is not like the imaginary first down line that I see on the, when I watch football games. Like it, there's no line there. Like it doesn't, there is no way to sort of, you know, cordon this off. It's going to connect to different systems structurally, mechanically, electrically, plumbing wise. Like you can't just, that line is very porous. So what you're talking about, you're doing is you did the work and then your phases subsequently filled out. So it was almost like you stacked as opposed to sort of bubbled. Which is kind of a weird way of saying that, but I like the way that you talk about structuring that phasing because I think it's very different from what people generally think of as phasing.
I would offer one other suggestion to homeowners, working with architects, because this is something that we, and this isn't really anything to do with my project, but be honest with your architect about the budget.
Yes.
Don't hide your money.
Thank you. Thank you.
Because that happened a lot with us, and I know it happens with you as well. And, you know, people have more than, because they watch HGTV and they tell you inaccuracies about how the process actually works.
Right.
If an architect
lies, they're lies, Mark.
Yeah. architects are not going to spend your money just because you have the money. If you tell them that you have this amount, but you only want to spend this amount, that's different than, you know, not telling them about that amount, right? Because the project will be different. It'll be better if they know the truth. Because often what happens is that you'll design the cheaper project, you'll go to build it, and then the magic money will come in. I want to expose that. And now because the magic money just appeared, you're adding into something that wasn't planned for. And it's never as good as it could have been if you just told us the money was there in the first place and that you had planned to spend it. We promise that we will be responsible with your money. It's part of our job.
Part of being a steward. Yeah, that's our job.
And also on top of that, when someone says, well, I don't want to tell you my budget because then you're going to spend it all.
Right.
And I'm like, well, then don't tell me a number you're not comfortable spending all of.
Exactly. Be honest with yourself as well as your architect.
Yes. And so if someone says, I have $100,000 for this project, then the next question I'm always asking is, because homeowners speak of project budget, not construction budget. So they actually, that 100,000 has to include everything. They're thinking about the furniture they're going to put in.
Yeah.
They're thinking about, they don't know that the architect's fees are usually separate from that. They don't know that, you know, a survey might be separate from that, or going through zoning might cost money that's different than that. So their construction budget may actually only be 50,000 after they're done taking all that other stuff out. And by the way, contingency, you should set aside for contingency.
And the way I presented contingency is that I always presented it in a way that this is money that we are going to spend. We just don't know what it's spending, what we're going to spend it on yet. It's not money that we're hiding and that, you know, if you need it, it'll be there. No, it's going to be needed. This is a renovation project. Things that we don't expect are going to happen. And that money is there to pay for those things that we know are there. We just don't know what they are yet.
100K, and you say, and I'm just using a number just out of the blue, and you say, okay, 20K is contingency.
Right.
You know, XK is for architect, XK is for this, and then what's left over is what we can spend on the kitchen or the whatever.
And the 20K will be spent.
Will be spent, yeah, because you will open up walls and you will find crazy stuff.
Yeah, every time.
Every time.
I'll share a quick story. When I did my first renovation in Birmingham, we ended up in the project at the very last piece, and I was trying to convince the homeowner to take a porch off the garage so that we could do a 3-point turn with a minivan in the driveway. Like, this is the kind of projects. And he looked at me and he said, nope. And I was like, why? Because at this point in the project, the only thing we're going to fund is Confederate money or a Native American burial ground, and neither of which are going to help me pay for the rest of this job. That's all.
Got to know when to fold them.
So, Mark, I think you have told us a couple of things that you would do differently, knowing what you know. And because I know you, have done another project since then. Did you do anything different then on your second project, knowing what you learned on the first?
Well, my second project is when we moved to North Carolina. So in 2017, my in-laws, who were in New York, who were helping raise our children. And now by this point, my children were, you know, older. They were teenagers in high school and college. So this is a long way to answer your question.
Okay.
My in-laws would go down to North Carolina to visit their sons, my wife's brothers, who lived in Charlotte. And they would just go down to visit every year. And we were in New York, not with Anne-Marie's brothers. And coincidentally, my brothers, who were also in Charlotte within an hour of my brother-in-law's, but we were still in New York. But we were in New York because my in-laws were in New York. They were never moving. 2017, they went down to visit and they bought a house while they were there.
Oh. So it all changed.
My brother-in-law brought them to show them a house, never imagining that they would buy a house. And my mother-in-law said, oh, this is nice. I could imagine living here. And that was all he needed. He had a realtor there. 15 minutes later, he had a realtor there. Oh, and about an hour later, they had a deal.
Sounds like a plan that was hatched.
and they didn't know, and we didn't know. And they came home and they said, we bought a house. We're moving to Charlotte. And we're like, I looked at Emery and said, when are we moving? Because the only reason we were there was because were there, and we were going to be there as long as they were there. We wanted to make sure that we were there with them to support them and to have them be able to support us. And so when they left, we're like, okay, we're going to go too. And so they wrapped up in 90 days. They cleaned up a house that they had lived in for 50 years, sold it, and moved to North Carolina.
Wow. Wow.
Within, amazing, you know, 3 or 4 months of I will never move to now living in North Carolina.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, but we were practicing in New York. And so we had a firm with clients and projects. And so we decided, okay, we're going to finish all of our projects, you know, go through all our commitments, finished everything. And a year and a half, we moved to North Carolina as well. And the house that we bought was a house that was a short sale. And that's a whole other story. The short sale, the realtor of the house that was selling the short sale house was the owner of the house that was having a short sale who didn't want his house to be sold. I don't know how that's legal or how it worked out, but he was a licensed realtor and he was the selling agent on the house. Ooh. My realtor did not like that her profession was being played with that way. So she was going to get this house for us. And Anne-Marie loved this house and wasn't going to let that happen. And so we ended up buying the house. But the house was built in 1993 and had never been renovated. So we bought it in 2019. It was built in 1993 and was still 1993. So the kitchen, somewhere along the line, the kitchen probably was renovated. And so this house was in great shape, but was still 1993. The outside was synthetic stucco with fake arched windows, this horribly proportioned front entrance with these ceramic tile stairs that went up that were like 12 by 12 riser runs, this horrible front entrance. and again, we saw it and looked right past all of that and said, we're going to make this into this beautiful little house. And so we bought it and we did a full whole house exterior renovation on it. So put a whole, replaced all the windows and doors, put a huge sliding glass door off the kitchen. The house originally had these big, when you walked into the living room, these big windows that looked out to the backyard. And removed all of the stucco, which we thought was going to be a huge problem because synthetic stucco in the 90s in the South is a mold problem for everybody.
Welcome to my world.
We removed that stucco and there was one place with a leaky window that had rotted wood.
So lucky.
And we were incredibly lucky. And so we had that money budgeted to fix that problem and that problem didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so removed the stucco, put all new windows in, put up hardy clapboards and made it look like this little southern white cottage. Removed that front entrance, put a new front porch on it, and renovated. And that was the first phase. So full exterior renovation. Second phase was, a new kitchen and dining room. So we replaced the 19, probably early 2000s kitchen, replaced that. And so lessons, we project managed it. And that probably was a problem because we were trying to save money and we hired some people who said they could do projects at a certain time limit. Mm-hmm. We were new to the South, Northerners moving to the South, not realizing that the South moves at a different time zone.
Different pace.
Yeah. Very different pace, which we love today and loved then, but didn't recognize that translated to contractors.
And you probably didn't know the contractors.
We didn't know any of the contracts. Yeah, contractors were all, we were lucky to know architects down here because of Entree Architect. I have a very large network, so I know architects everywhere in the United States. Mm-hmm. And so when I moved here, I had friends here who helped me recommend contractors, and that was a huge help. Don Duffy, I don't know if any of you know Don Duffy, mm-hmm. Was a huge help. He lives close by and has helped mm-hmm. us with this. And that, you know, that was a big part of how we got it done. Oh, the lesson was not knowing, you know, the way that contractors pace themselves in the South. We hired the siding guys, which were two brothers who showed up on a pickup truck who did a fantastic job, but it took about 4 months to re-side the exterior of our house. Yeah, I think references and understanding the, you know, the backgrounds mm-hmm. of contractors, even if yeah. they're great contractors and great people, you know, someone could have told us that, which we didn't check. We just, you know, used the, yep. the referrals. Great people. Great job. Yeah. Just took a lot longer than we expected.
So Marilyn, to wrap this up, you want to ask our final question?
We'd love to hear something that about the finished, your finished home, whether it's the one in New York or the one in North Carolina, that something that every time you see it, you just love it.
There's a lot to love in both houses. I mean, we put so much love.
That's a great
answer. We put so much love into both houses. I mean, the Chappaqua house was a, you know, the whole thing was a done out of love to save the house. And so everything there, we miss that house a lot. There's not much I miss about New York. I really love where we moved, and New York has a really, you know, stressful environment to live in. But I love the house. I miss the house tremendously. But the house that we're in today is awesome. It's much bigger than the house in New York. And I would say my favorite space is our screen porch. We didn't have a screen porch in New York. And mm-hmm. North Carolina has fantastic weather. And, you know, 9 months of the year, you can be outside and yeah. probably more than that. And I eat breakfast outside every day and lunch outside every day. Aww. And it's my screen porch. And so I would say,
love it. You know,
yeah.
Great.
But I love it all. I'll send you pictures.
I follow you on Instagram. I've been watching it. There's the little back house. You've got window boxes. I've seen it all.
That back house is a whole another episode.
Back house. Like.
Cool. That's true.
That's yes. Henry's house.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for coming on and sharing, you know, first of all, your journey with Entree Architect and how we all met. And then your journey with your renovation. I think we get a lot of good tidbits that our listeners can pay attention to and maybe take into their own project.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It was an honor and a pleasure to be part of this. I was excited Thanks. To be on it.
It was our honor.
I yeah. didn't get choked up.
So that was a great episode with Mark, and we all love him, of course. A lot of stories about the projects that he's done. I thought it was interesting. The point I pulled out of it early on was just how architects tend to see potential yeah. in projects
yep.
that maybe people that are going to see a house don't. You know, the other ones that put in offers were going to tear the house down. And they saw some potential there and made it into a home that they ultimately loved.
Because they saw that potential, they were actually able to get a house in a very expensive area for real estate. So because they were willing to see the potential in something that maybe others were passing by or that just developers were going to buy and tear down, that enabled them to kind of get in to a market that otherwise they might not have been able to get into. And I think, you know, that's the case for all of us. It's certainly the case for a lot of my clients in the Boston area. It's a tough market a lot of times. And so you got to kind of come in and see those opportunities for a project that you can really make special. Even if yeah. it doesn't look very special on day one.
Mm-hmm. I'll say this, the thing that came through for me was how much love they had for that house and how
yeah.
much it was sort of part of their family. It's like a character in their family story. And I think, you know, lots of people feel that way, but architects, residential architects feel that way about houses acutely.
Yes. Yes. You know, we love them.
We love them. So we love on them. We love them. We love the fact that you love your house. So working with someone who loves houses like you love your house mm-hmm. inevitably makes for a better project. That's why we do this, is because we love them so much. And you could hear so much of that emotion as he was talking about his project.
Absolutely.
And technically being stewards of the home.
That's right.
And I think that's where we come in sometimes, where we understand the feelings that go mm-hmm. into a home and why you love a home. And being a steward of a building is very important. And they're not disposable. They're not supposed to be disposable and tear one down and build a bigger one behind it. I really liked that perspective of his.
I did too. And I also think that laced sort of throughout Mark's stories and comments was also just that importance or an advantage of having someone who's thinking strategically about how to do projects. So mm-hmm. isn't just like, what do we want the kitchen to look like? But it's much more, how do we get this project executed right, that fits right. our family, that fits our lifestyle, that fits our budget, that fits our plan and our time horizon for being in this home? And I think that's something that I wish people knew more. And so I guess we're here talking about it, but that architects are here not just to draw up plans and that's it, but to help you even to help homeowners early in the process with strategizing. You know, what's going to be possible here? What, you know, how can we make this work for you over the course of the 20 years that you might be in the home? So there's master planning that's about the renovation, and we're going to do the electrical and we're going to fix the kitchen and we're going to, but there's also master planning about your budget and your family and your, you know, that kind of thing that we're there to do. And we have experience with that. And I hope people take that away from Mark's comments as well.
And of course, we're always grateful to Mark for bringing us together.
Absolutely.
100%. Yeah. We would not know each other without him. So we are very grateful.
I'm always surprised how, when we say what the dates are, like how long we've known each other.
How long is, yes, yes, I know. We can't be that old.
Oh, that was just a couple years ago.
No, we're not.
Thank you so much for joining us today on Home the Second Story. If you'd like to come on the show and share your story, email us at admin@htsspodcast.com. We'd love to have you as a guest. For more inspiring homeowner stories and tips, we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. You know, revisiting that story reminds me how much our own homes shape the way we practice, the way we lead, and how we serve the people who trust us with their projects. Those experiences taught me about stewardship, phasing, budgets, and the realities every homeowner faces, no matter how long we've been in this profession. So if today's conversation sparked ideas for your own work or your own home, I'd love to continue the discussion inside the Entree Architect community or at the Entree Architect Network at entrearchitect.com. And a very special thank you to my friends, Marilyn Modinger, Sherry Scott, and Taylor Davis for inviting me to be a guest on Home, the Second Story. They're doing some very meaningful, important work for homeowners and for our profession. So if you enjoyed this episode, please go subscribe to their podcast feed and support what they're doing. We will include a link to the show in the show notes. And thanks again to RCAT for supporting this episode. If you're not already using RCAT as part of your daily process, give it a try. Their library of specs, BIM content, and product data can save you hours on every project. So visit RCAT.com. That's ARCAT.com and see how much easier your next set of documents can be. If you enjoyed this episode of Entree Architect Podcast, please share a link with a friend, because that's how we've continued to grow and serve thousands more small firm architects just like you. Thank you to our sponsors for this episode. Links to the sponsors and all the resources we discussed today They are all available in the show notes for this episode at entrearchitect.com/podcast. Entree Architect is a proud member of the Gable Media Network. It's the multimedia network moving the architecture, engineering, and construction industries forward through the power of storytelling. You can earn AIA continuing education credits by listening to select episodes of this podcast and many others at gablemedia.com/members. And if you are a small firm architect, listen up. Join us today at Entree Architect Network. It's the worldwide community for entrepreneur architects. We've been around since 2012, and our basic level is now free to join. Yes, you can join Entree Architect Network for free. And that gives you access to valuable business resources and our global community of architects. And you can upgrade anytime for live coaching, AIA-approved training, and mastermind support. So visit entrearchitect.com to learn more and to get started. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to the Entree Architect Podcast. Love, learn, share. Are you NCARB certified yet? Join the network of over 45,000 architects who have the NCARB certificate to expand your professional reach. By becoming NCARB certified, you are demonstrating that you've met the national standards for licensure, a qualification that can be an important factor for firms when hiring and promoting. Certificate holders have a streamlined path to apply for a reciprocal license in all 55 U.S. jurisdictions, as well as access to an extensive library of free continuing education courses. Learn more today at ncarb.org.